Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte clear liners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you could pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
The Angie's List you know and trust is now Angie, and we're so much more than just a list. We still connect you with top local pros and show you ratings and reviews, but now we also let you compare upfront prices on hundreds of projects and book a service instantly. We can even handle the rest of your project from start to finish. So remember, Angie's List is now Angie, and we're here to get your job done right. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I, or download the app today.
I'm George Chen.
And I'm Paco Romain.
And you're listening to the SupDoc podcast, where we talk to interesting people with strong opinions about their favorite documentaries.
What do four men with very different jobs have in common?
That's the question at the heart of the 1997 documentary, Fast, Cheap, and Out of Control, directed by Errol Morris.
And we caught up with today's guest, Jesse Thorne, early podcast pioneer, host of Bullseye, and founder of the Maximum Fun Network at his studio in Los Angeles. Well, we're here with Jesse Thorne. Thanks for meeting with us, Jesse.
Oh, it's a pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Appreciate it. We're here in the Maximum Fun vocal booth of fun. But we're here to talk about Fast, Cheap, and Out of Control. I think you picked a great one.
I think so, too.
I love this documentary.
Yeah. This was the first thing that came to mind when we approached you about doing the series?
Yeah, I mean, I think this is one of my favorite movies ever. Errol Morris, one of my favorite filmmakers ever. He's been a guest on my show, and he's like every bit as lovely and delightful as you could possibly hope he would be. Like, I was worried, because sometimes when you admire someone that much, you're like, what if they disappoint me?
Yeah, absolutely.
And he delivered big time. I love all of Errol Morris's work. And, you know, I think also that Errol Morris is the filmmaker who has been most influential in one of my business worlds, which is public radio. So, yeah, there you go. But nice. I love Fast, Cheap, and Out of Control. It's my favorite one.
Does he go by Errol, or does he have, like, call me Air?
Big E.
The Big E? Call me the Big E. I can't. So does he live in L.A.?
No, I think he lives in Massachusetts. He lives in New England somewhere.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, I think he comes into L.A. to, you know, make quadrillion-dollar commercials from time to time, and then... Did you know Errol Morris directed? Do you remember these commercials for Miller High Life that were like, they were shot in like square format, like 16 millimeter, kind of like Kodachrome-y colors, like looked like real home photographs from the 50s with a lot of extreme close-ups.
Oh, yeah.
And then there was a voiceover, like a super manly voiceover talking about the Miller man.
Yeah.
The High Life Man, excuse me.
The High Life Man. I do kind of, was there a lot of tungsten yellow involved?
Yeah, the High Life Man always cuts his own grass, but blah, 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 blah. Anyway, they're totally amazing commercials, which is not something I say lightly.
No, yeah.
And I found out that Errol Morris directed them.
Wow, that's pretty cool.
And I interviewed him about that. When I was interviewing him, I'm like, I'm going to ask him about these High Life Man commercials that he directed. And I'm like, Errol Morris, I'm sorry that I'm going to like take time out of this interview about your movie that you have out and like all of your important work to ask you about this commercial job you did. But like, you directed these High Life commercials, and he sort of like cut me off and was like, Jesse, if I died and was remembered for only one thing, and it was those High Life commercials, I would be fine with that.
Oh, wow.
Like, that's how proud of those High Life commercials Errol Morris is.
Yeah. Wow. I wonder if he uses the same cinematographer he uses for his documentaries.
Yeah, I wonder, too. I mean, it's such a look.
Yeah, it is such a look. Well, the same guy that, like, was the cinematographer on Fast, Cheap, and Out of Control was the same. I think he's worked with Errol in the past, and he also did... He did a couple other great movies that I'm escaping now. Oliver Stone. What's the one with Rodney Dangerfield?
Ladybugs.
Ladybugs.
Back to School. No.
I mean, it's Oliver Stone movie with...
With Rodney... with Woody Harrelson, yeah. Juliette Lewis.
It's not called Dirty Rotten Scoundrels, but
American Terrible Youth. Yeah, I think that's what it is. The Japanese translation is American Terrible Youth. It's something like that. I'm blanking on it too. Natural Born Killers. NBK. NBD. Yeah.
Born Killers. I want to highlight. Does sound a lot like Dirty Rotten Scoundrels.
It does. And
that's
around the same
why
time
I said that. I couldn't think of what it was called, but I knew it
we
had
all
that
had collective. Unmemory for that one.
If Oliver Stone had directed Dirty Rotten Scoundrels, a very different type of film. Or maybe not. Just like,
I don't know.
There's a conspiracy, there's some fraud.
Yeah. So what was the first Errol Morris documentary you watched, Jesse?
It might have been Fast, Cheap, and Out of Control. I think. What do you have on your note what year it came
That's
out?
That's 97.
Like 97? So yeah. I think I saw it in the theater when I was 16.
Nice.
And I may have seen it. I used to belong to this thing. I went to School of the Arts in San Francisco, and I used to belong to this thing called Cine Club, which was where local teens, mm-hmm. would go to art movies.
Nice. And they joined, what was it, CNET?
Cine.
Cine.
Yes, in Cinema.
I've heard of this school. Yeah, this is like the art school. And like the
Yeah, it's like Fame.
Show. Yeah,
it's
yeah.
like Fame. And this was like a loosely affiliated extracurricular program.
Uh-huh.
This was not, I was choosing to spend my free time going to art movies.
Did you ever go to ATA at all when you lived in San Francisco?
No, but ATA was down the block from where I grew up. Mm-hmm, yeah, mm-hmm. Like I grew up right in the neighborhood there.
Yeah.
What was your favorite art house cinema place to go check out films?
You know, there used to be, I mean, the Castro.
Yeah.
But I grew up like two blocks from, the Castro is this beautiful movie palace in San Francisco with a pipe organ. And
that comes out of the floor.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And goes back into the floor triumphantly. Yeah, it's great. I saw 2001 in 70 millimeter there.
Wow.
That was like totally amazing. Wow. And I was like, you know how some people think 2001 is boring and stuff? It's because it is. But you watch it on a giant screen in like an amazing movie theater in 70 millimeter, and there's the whole time you're just like, gah. Like it's so amazing. And I also saw Dial M for Murder in 3D there.
Oh, I went to that too. Was that around like 98 or something?
Probably something
like
that.
Yeah, I think I saw that screening too. Yeah.
That was great. But I grew up a couple blocks from, the Roxy on 16th Street in San Francisco. So
still there. Yeah.
Many of my movie memories are the going to the Roxy, which is sort of weird for a kid to be going to like an art rep house.
Yeah. It is.
But I guess that's where my mom was taking me.
Yeah.
It's a cool mom.
I did see Star Wars there.
I saw
the whole Star Wars trilogy in like 19, you know, when I was like six or something, six or seven, I don't know, late 80s.
Wow.
At the Roxy.
At the Roxy.
Yeah.
I will credit, like, I grew up in San Jose, which is not known for much cultural output, but there was a really good series of like rep house movie theaters. So everything about like underground culture or whatever, subcultural things, I picked up a lot of that just because there was this like series of theaters like the Camera 1, 2, and 3 in downtown San Jose.
Yeah, living here in Los Angeles is a real bummer for art house movie theaters because if you live on the west side of Los Angeles, there are a few great ones. But like 85% of Los Angeles just like does not have access to art films.
Right. Mm-hmm. Have you been to Cinefamily?
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, Cinefamily is an example of a very good art house film. We actually did a screening. We sponsored a screening of a movie called 1,000 Clowns there a few years ago and had Barry Gordon, who was the child star of the film and later went on to be, I want to say, Donatello in the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. And
the voice of, not a tiny Filipino breakdancer.
And also got a law degree at Loyola here in L.A. and became president of SAG. Was like a longtime president of SAG.
The guy that played Donatello.
Yeah.
Wow.
Might have been Raphael.
Yeah, that's a nice career arc. I do have to say a little anecdote is I went to Camera One in, yeah, San Jose. On that boardwalk or whatever. I went to see a movie with Mr. T at Camera One.
Oh. I have a friend who's actually a documentary filmmaker who made a movie called Straight Outta Hunters Point.
Oh, yeah.
Named Kevin. And Kevin, around the time when that movie came out, it's a documentary about Hunters Point in San Francisco. He was like getting invited to do like loose category I would describe as black stuff. And one thing was he was at like homecoming week at Howard or something like that, as a guest of, you know, the Black Film Club or something like that. And the other guest of the Black Film Club was Mr. T. And so he spent like 2 or 3 days walking around the campus of Howard with Mr. T.
Sweet.
And he said like he's never lived like that.
Yeah.
Like just hounded 24 hours a day.
Yeah.
A living meme, yeah.
I spent a week with him. We shot a series of Japanese Hitachi commercial ads. And we went out and had some steaks one night. And he said, Paco, I always eat dessert before I eat my meal. Because you never know when you're going to die. And I was like, God, I love this man. Yeah. He was a very sweet cat. He was a very sweet guy.
I have that Straight Outta Hunters Point soundtrack CD, which is apparently like not on Discogs or anything. I was like trying to be like, look this thing up. I've actually never seen the film. I always assumed it was a fictional narrative. I've never realized it was a documentary.
It's a documentary, yeah. It's a good one. I think the two great San Francisco documentaries of that ilk are that movie and a movie called Alias Don Bonus.
Right, I have heard of that one.
That's a movie made by this, like a 17-year-old kid who lived in Sunnyside Projects, if I'm remembering correctly.
Yeah, I've seen that.
Yeah. And yeah, it's just really amazing. I mean, it's like, I think it's on YouTube.
I actually saw that in a documentary film class that I took at Berkeley, where I did like an ethnic studies documentary film class. And a lot of people that were in that actually went on to make documentaries. I did not. I just learned how to edit videotape. Mm-hmm. That's how long ago it was.
It's the official, yeah. I mean, it is definitely the official film of an ethnic studies class in the Bay Area in 1998.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, right. Sounds exactly right, yeah.
Just like Fast, Cheap, and Out of Control.
Yeah.
I think.
Yeah, I thought that had come out more recently than that. I didn't realize it was back in 97, yeah.
Yeah, he was, Errol Morris was knocking one out of the park every year there for a while. This is also one of my, I saw this at the Red Vic. And that's what I was asking about, which one that you like to go see, because the Red Vic was my place to go on Haight Street. Right. I used to go see this one all the time. I love this documentary. This is our first Errol Morris doc that we've talked about, too, which is pretty cool. So if when you guys are watching it, like, what was your first impressions as it started, like, what did you think about how he was introducing the characters?
I think I had seen... My stepmother was a big Bravo fan when Bravo was actually the arts network. And I think I had seen First Person, which was his television series.
Oh, yeah.
Which was right around the same time. It may be that I saw it immediately afterwards and someone is going to send me an email that says, I'm sorry, your timelines don't align.
Do you get those emails?
Oh, God, yes.
Yeah, I'm sure.
We're going to get those listeners, ones that nitpick everything.
Let's hope.
They're going to love that Kurt Cobain episode.
But, you know, I mean, what's interesting to me about Fast, Cheap, and Out of Control is that it is essentially, you know, like many of Errol Morris's documentaries, it is essentially a talking head film. But it is a talking head film that is that basically blows out the entire universe. Oh, you know what? It was not the first Errol Morris movie I saw, because speaking of the entire universe and the Roxy Theater, I think I saw A Brief History of Time at the Roxy.
Nice.
With my mom when I was like 8.
Your mom rocks.
My mom's interesting.
Yeah, she sounds very... That's it. Brief History of Time is one of the most fascinating documentaries I had seen at the time. I remember watching him just being like, how does he do this?
It's definitely the top documentary that features a robot voice going, and as they approach the event horizon of the black hole, they are turned into spaghetti.
Yeah, that computer voice is amazing.
Turned into spaghetti.
Did you guys have any of the four talking heads? Did you guys like one more in particular or dislike one?
I was surprised that you could be Australian and sound like Chris Walken. That's what I thought was interesting about the robot guy at first. I'm like, what? I think it's Australian, but it's super Chris Walken-y. And then once I realized he was Australian, that kind of went away. But for the first like 5 minutes, I'm like, why is Chris Walken talking about robots? It's very strange.
That's your Christopher Walken.
That's not. I know. I'm not known for much, but definitely not my impressions. But yeah, no. I liked the mole rat guy. He was very compelling in his nerdiness and his little butterfly bow tie.
There's a guy. These four main characters are a guy who is a biologist of naked mole rats.
And, Ray Mendez. Mm-hmm.
There is a guy who is a topiary artist.
George Mendonca.
There is a guy who is a animal trainer, like a large animal trainer, especially big cat trainer.
Right, Dave Hoover.
And then there is a guy who builds biological-like robots at MIT or something. Right,
right. Mm-hmm. Randy Brooks, yeah.
And I think I read that he, if I'm remembering correctly, Errol Morris was doing these interviews independently and decided to weave them together as a feature film when he realized that they had themes in common.
When they come through the door, you've got about 3 seconds to do what we call read them. Are they coming after you? If you're not scared of them, you're in big trouble.
I've been told by several people, well, you're old-fashioned. You want to do everything by hand. This is the only way you can do it and do it right.
A friend of mine called me and he said to me, Ray, they found them. And I said, where? And he said, in Africa. It's a thing called a naked mole rat, and they have a society just like termites.
When I switched the things on, the lights flashed and the machine came to life. It moved. Some people believe that we are going to replace ourselves by building these machines, and that may be.
I love how it starts out. I love how each one is portrayed independently. And then as the doc gets moving, how they like weave and drop different narratives on top of different scenes from different parts of the documentary and the different parts of the films that they use to like – hold those up.
Right. There's sort of like the footage they took of all the circus stuff, which I assume was from the lion taming stuff. And then there is also that old black and white sci-fi stuff, which was Beatty, I believe was the guy's name, that was a big inspiration for...
Clyde Beatty, yeah.
Yeah. He was a big inspiration for our lion tamer to get into wild animal training.
So. Darkest Africa was that black and white.
Yes. That's...
That's some fine acting in Darkest Africa. Yeah. I love the security guys in their wings and their helmets. Mm-hmm. I love how when you watch some of those old films, the long takes, the really slow edits, you know, the different takes they use.
Yeah, like the serials, the black and white serial action stuff. Yeah. I liked basically at a certain point when the voiceovers come in and you kind of it could be any of the four people and it's applicable to the footage. That's interesting when that starts to happen. And, there'll be shots of the mole rats, and then there'll be the voiceover from the lion tamer, or there'll be the voiceover from the topiary guy. I found the topiary thing felt like it had the least, like, at stake in a certain way, but maybe I'm viewing that wrong. It seemed like he really invested a lot in the topiary.
Here's what I think about the topiary guy. So, like, the theme of the film, as far as I'm concerned, is, you know, what is the nature of life, right? And the topiary guy's significance is that he is the one, he and the lion tamer are the ones who are closest to their own deaths.
Right.
And so the topiary guy is asking the question, what happens to my topiaries, which are things that are... you know, lifelike, you know, I'm using life to create a simulacrum of other life, right? Because he's making animals out of plants. Mm-hmm. And he knows that there's no one who will be able to pursue his work after he's gone. And so, you know, it brings into very vivid contrast, you know, the questions of life and death, which I think are very important also to the lion tamer who's always looking at his own death.
And all of a sudden he has four points of interest. He loses his original chain of thought because this agitates him. He can't comprehend those four points of interest. So what he does, he attacks the chair. He takes his wrath out on the chair.
I saw the tamer, the animal trainer and the topiary guy as being the kind of the people that don't use the kind of the past versus the mole guy and the robots guy kind of representing the future. Like both those guys were both scientists, and the trainer and the topiary guy were both guys who used their hands and struggled a lot, you know, like on ladders and then with lines that could bite your head off.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting. Yeah, like physical guys that worked with their hands and did like sort of represent this old school like form of labor versus like this brain labor.
Yeah. Yeah, there's definitely a lot of brain labor involved, especially with the robotics guy. When he was talking about Rodney Brooks, when he was talking about the television screen cleaner.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. The dust mites that you could just program. It would clean your TV screen.
Yeah. That was cracking me up because I was like, of all the things you could think of. He was, you know, that's where his brain went, was like how to clean a TV screen.
I had a dirty TV screen in 1997. I don't know about you. Probably still do.
Yeah. Probably still do. Yeah, I mean, I thought that was the most interesting thing. So, did you relate with one of these guys more than
Jesse? Like, the naked mole rat guy is the most fun guy. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like, that guy is super fun. Mm-hmm. And the robot guy is also fun. I mean, they're both, like, the kind of, like, crazy nerd uncle that one would like to have. I mean, I actually did have a nerd uncle who had, like, I would go visit him in Washington, D.C., and he would have robotics with an X at the end of them, which was like Kinex, but with
like Legos, but they had like electrode parts or something. Yeah,
yeah, like motors and stuff and gears. But yeah, they remind you of that kind of quality. They're the most fun, but I don't know. There's something very captivating to me about the animal trainer who has this. You know, he has this avocation that is, you know, handed down person to person, you know, and has a certain kind of grand quality, which is built into it, not only because it's a performance, but because if you do not have that, if you lose that quality, you are killed. You know, like if you lose this projection of power, the tigers or lions just eat you.
That felt like a stand-up comedy kind of lesson too, just like fake it till you make it. It's completely like 100% fake it, like because he talks about being injured and then just making just like convincing the lions you're not injured, because if you it's like all a bluff. That's an interesting part of that one. But yeah, like also when he gets to the point, I think both him and the guy who does the topiary stuff, they talk about like not being able to find or the topiary guy can't find a replacement. He's found like a younger woman who he's trained to also do the lion stuff. But it's yeah, like that idea of a legacy is definitely more prominent with the topiary, because already he was doing it for an older woman who was like obsessed with her own mortality. And it also was just like this weird private entertainment for her. Almost, you know, the entire time until it became more open to the public. Does anyone know if he's still alive or if the...
I killed him.
Yeah, he killed him.
With a lion.
With shears, yeah. like you were talking about that idea of the legacy, whereas like MIT is going to keep doing robots and naked mole rats are not going to go extinct.
I think that with these robotics, you know, one of the questions is, if you build learning robots, which is what this guy was doing, his idea was to basically build complex emergent systems with the robot. So a few inputs and that gets you a complex output, right? You know, you give them three rules. You know, you turn around when you smell this and you go up when you run into something or whatever. And the behaviors emerge, like with ants or something or naked mole rats. And I think that, you know, many people's reaction to the idea of evolving or learning robots that could potentially eclipse human beings is that this is a nightmare. And I think it's telling that this roboticist sees it as a legacy. You know, in the same way that he sees that because these creatures that he's creating have emergent qualities, they will sustain themselves and be humankind's legacy in exactly the way that the topiary guy wishes his topiaries could, because he won't be there to control them anymore. They will grow wild and no longer be topiaries, right? They'll no longer be these representations of life. But this roboticist, because he is creating representations of life that are emergent, sees them as, you know, essentially an artwork, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I feel like you got the, I got the, like, the eccentricities of each of them as the movie went on. You learn that they, these guys not only do something very specific and very kind of unusual, but they also are very close to the subject matter of, and they love what they do. Like, the mole man just seemed to really, really love those moles. As much as somebody can love a naked, blind mole.
There's this saying, there's this sort of maxim in journalism, and particularly broadcast journalism, which is that people are at their most interesting when they're talking about the thing that they care about the most. And, you know, one of the things that Errol Morris has made the hallmark of his career is finding people with passions so huge that they are fascinating no matter what the subject of their passion is. So, like, he has made movies about, you know, Robert McNamara. And, you know, obviously the Vietnam War is a huge, big deal that we all care about one way or another as Americans, right? But he also made a really amazing movie, I don't know if you saw this, for Grantland, the ESPN website, about an underground, when I say underground, literally underground, it takes place in a basement, electronic football league. Oh, and when I say electronic football, I'm talking about the kind that, like, shakes on a table.
Shaky ones, yeah.
Like the magnetic kind.
Right. I love those.
And this group of dudes who have been running this league and, like, keeping stats and, you know, they all have their own teams and they paint the players and they have a stadium built into this basement for decades.
Wow.
And that is something that no one should care about. You know, like, oh great, they're playing this, it's not even like they're playing, you know, Stratomatic baseball. It's like a simulation. It's like the worst game ever.
Yeah,
you know, it's a, electronic football is marked primarily by what a lousy recreation of football it is, you know. Yeah. And but the fact that it's like all that these guys care and believe about care about and believe in is what makes it such a fascinating thing. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, he did this in this series. It was all about sports. So he did like 5, 10, 15 minute documentaries. And one of them was about a guy who was a Mr. Met, which is the mascot of the New York Mets. One of them was about this legendary streaker.
Hmm.
Who had streaked at every...
The woman?
And it's a dude.
Oh, the dude.
And not the Kissing Bandit.
Oh, right. Yeah, the Kissing Bandit.
Although I did see the Kissing Bandit kiss Jose Canseco once live in person.
Wow.
At the Oakland Coliseum in like 1990.
Nice.
That was a real highlight of my life.
She showed up.
Yep. No, this guy's a streaker. He shows his donger. And he's streaked at like the Super
the
Bowl.
The naked mole rat.
Super Bowl, Wimbledon.
Wow.
Like every major international sporting event, the World Series. He's like Australian or something. No, he's English. Maybe he's English. I'm having a hard time remembering. But, you know, like these are just odd things. There's a thing about sports-themed funerals that he made. Not just caskets, but like one woman who was such a huge football fan, I want to say she was a Ravens fan, that she built an entire... that she basically had her funeral be her lying in state in her favorite recliner in a recreation of the room in which she liked to watch the Ravens, right?
Wow.
I think it was the Ravens. I might be getting that wrong. But
these are all for, on the Grantland website? That
Yeah.
So these are all up there.
Yeah, okay. These are all up there, and you can watch them for free. And the thing is the thing about all those things that they share is these uncommonly huge passions, you know,
mm-hmm.
that – even though the stakes for those of us on the in the outside world are modest at best, the stakes for those people in their worlds are huge. And it's the same with, you know, the same with First Person, which was his show that was basically an interview show turned into a documentary show with one person talking to the camera and, you know, some of his sort of filmic tricks and whatnot.
Yeah, First Person was great. I loved watching that.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective, unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
If Errol Morris was to make a documentary about you, Jesse, what would you talk about?
I don't think I'm single-minded enough for Errol Morris. Yeah, he could probably make a 7-minute documentary about my feelings about Babe Pig in the City or Pootie Tang. Just me being excited about Pootie Tang.
That movie excites you?
I think there's a good 7-minute documentary to be made about the very small, deeply passionate fan bases of those two films.
Would you eat a robot?
I would.
Would you eat robot meat in the future when there's like naked mole rat robots? Are we going to have like sentient meat?
I would
that's
love
robots?
That.
It's going to be like Arnold Schwarzenegger Terminator meat.
Would you guys eat that meat that's not part of an animal? It's just meat?
Just like muscle that they built in a lab? That's supposed to be pretty good. Yeah, it's just too expensive to make, right?
Yeah.
That's
what I'm hearing. I'm sure I'd eat it.
Let's see what Errol Morris makes about the muscle tissue meat. Industry. Like going back to that. Yeah, like that idea, I hadn't thought about it so much in terms of like what is the meaning of life, but the fact that like he ends it with like a tribute to his grandparents, mm-hmm. I guess on his maternal side because there's different last names, made me think like, okay, he really seemed to identify something with the topiary guy with mortality. But I guess when the movie was first came out or when it was like the promotion around it, I thought of it as just like it's people with obsessive jobs, and I thought about it more as like in terms of like, oh, it's like I'm someone who collects records. I can kind of relate to obsession about mole rats in that way. Or
well,
maybe
one of the things that I really like about the movie is, I like that it is about very important and profound things, and that it is also fun.
Yeah, it's very fun.
I think that too often people are afraid. If they want to tackle an important topic like what do we leave after we die or what is the nature of life, which are the main questions of this movie, right? They assume that the tone has to be grave. And I think one of the wonderful things about Errol Morris and so much of his work is that he is a guy who takes delight in the delightful and is completely unembarrassed about that fact.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely.
The music is super whimsical. It's all circus music. There's all these circus shots in the background.
The music's amazing. I never even picked it up this last time. I just watched it again a couple nights ago. I didn't pick it up the first few times that I've seen it, how great the music is and the sound design. Like both of them are just – everything adds – he's such a genius, Errol Morris, to put all of that together and make a compelling movie about four guys and their jobs. You know, like that's what I love so much about Errol Morris. I mean, you guys have probably seen like Pet Sematary or Vernon, Florida or any of those like just bizarre subject matter that he makes so compelling. It's so fun to watch. And I know a lot of times it's given credit to the Interrotron, you know, the.
Yeah, I think this was one of the first Interrotron movies, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was.
Oh, yeah, I read about this. Yeah, so like the idea is that there was a special way to get the subject to look directly at the camera the way you would talk to a person.
Essentially what it is. So ordinarily when you're shooting a documentary, you are, you know, I've been both in front of and behind the camera in this situation, and you are looking just off of the sight line of the camera because you are talking to someone who is immediately to the left or above and or below the camera. Probably not above, but they'd have to be hanging upside down to get the right eye line. But You know, they're either they've got the camera on their shoulder, or they're standing right next to the lens, or whatever, to get the eye line as close to looking into the camera as possible. And that's even true. Like I did one of those talking head shows the other day for TV, produced by one of the people who produced like I Love the 80s.
Oh wow!
But it was like 30 years of Christmases. I don't know. If you invite me to be on television, I'll probably do it. That's the lesson we take from that. It was perfectly lovely. And, you know, what they had was a producer sitting about 2 feet to the left of the microphone, I mean, of the camera, you know, and so, and that is the closest you can get to looking into the camera, you know. And what Errol Morris does is he essentially takes a, what's that called that you read words off of?
A teleprompter. Right.
He takes a teleprompter, and rather than projecting words onto the teleprompter, he projects his face onto the teleprompter live. So he has a live feed of his face, and he is often in the other room watching a feed of the person. But essentially what it allows is when the person is looking at Errol Morris, they are looking directly into the camera, so it allows for a more intimate connection, which I think is one of the things that makes his talking heads different from other talking. I mean, it's easy to like overstate this goofy invention that he understands is goofy. That's why he called it the Interotron. Mm-hmm. But like, you know, the special thing about Errol Morris is how deeply he makes us feel. You know, partly it's about these kind of crazy recreations that he does and stock footage and the distinctive music and all these different things. But mostly it's about how in film, which is a very difficult medium in which to do this, he makes you feel a direct personal connection with a person who is telling their story. And I think that special quality is why his films and stuff are so influential in radio, which is a medium that is more naturally suited to people telling their stories. So, you know, like the defining thing in public radio the last 20 years is obviously This American Life. And This American Life, you know, Ira will go out of his way at the drop of a hat to give credit to Errol Morris as, you know, along with, there's a couple of other people. This guy called Joe Frank, who's a radio guy. But, you know, Errol Morris is the guy who essentially invented the kind of documentary that This American Life is, you know, translated for a different medium. But it's about that kind of how close of a connection can you get from someone telling their own story.
It also seems like on top of that, and well put, is like pre-Errol Morris, documentaries were just regulated to like PBS, some boring National Geographic stuff, and just like, you know, like almost newsworthy. And then Errol Morris put that kind of showbiz pop to it, you know, made it sexy.
I mean, he does things that they do on, you know, 2020 or whatever. Dateline. But he does them for things that are important in responsible ways and in non-corny ways, right?
Yeah.
And that's a really special thing.
It is very special. And it makes it – like it's fun to listen to and it's fun to watch, which is not something like a lot of documentaries used to have.
Yeah, like actually I'm trying to think, like, so these were all released theatrically, and there was documentaries that were released theatrically in that time period, but like you're saying, like a certain flavor, he's very influential on a whole generation of documentary.
Well, I mean, it's very difficult to make a to do what Errol Morris does, which is make documentaries that are often about ideas and people rather than events, and to make them in a context that is, you know, that's post facto. You know, like if you think about the great documentaries that went before, the Maisels and stuff like that, you know, you're talking about movies that were shot in a verite style over sometimes years to get enough interesting stuff.
Right, right.
And to get to find a narrative, you know, because you can't predict a narrative to although.
Well, like the 7-Up series.
Unless you're making Spellbound or something.
Yeah, yeah. Like the Apted docs, you know, filmed over many, many, many years. And
so I think Morris is someone who can take something that's really important or really fascinating and tell it retrospectively in a way that's nonetheless interesting in film, which is a real hard thing to do.
Yeah.
you know.
It brings a kind of auteur like authorship to the form that, whereas right, I think in a verite form, you don't necessarily. It's still about editing, but this is because of all the recreations and everything. So this one specifically really does feel it's such an art film kind of documentary. So yeah,
yeah, and it has the Errol Morris sense of humor, which is the other thing I love about his. Even in Fogs of War, when he's talking to McNamara, you know, it's. There's always this little bit of like a, it's not a wink, but it's kind of a smirk. It's this like.
Well, he's kind of a smirky. My favorite parts of his movies are like, you know, he's not necessarily on mic, right? So like you just hear him go, "What? Really?" from off mic. I'm just kind of, yeah, what about this? Yeah. You know, he's like constantly yelling at the people, you know?
Yeah, like David Lynch in Twin Peaks when he's like has hard of hearing or something, yeah. Yeah, there's one part at the very end of Fast GPM Control where he says something off camera, and I kind of missed the question, but yeah, it's about, I think, about, you know, death, I think.
Yeah. But, yeah, he does. He does ask one question off camera, in Fast, Cheap, and Out of Control, and it's always a little like, huh, I want to hear more from Errol Morris. I've never watched any of the DVD extras on any of his films. I wonder if there's a lot of that stuff.
I watched this on DVD, and there wasn't a commentary track on this one. But yeah, maybe the other ones do have commentary tracks. Yeah.
He's a real fascinating dude.
I'm sure.
When did you interview him, and what was it?
It was for his movie that was called Celebrity.
Oh, yeah, Celebrity.
Was that what it was called? Yeah. Which I loved.
Yeah, it's great.
He was just I interviewed him in a weird hotel conference room. A lot of times when people are on movie press, they, like, set up shop in a hotel. And it's hard, you know, we're trying to get him into the studio. But with Errol Morris, it was like, fuck it. Errol Morris is in town. Like,
you got to go to him.
Yeah, let's go take care of business. Let's get Errol Morris in here.
Amen. Yeah.
And, I mean, he is super funny. He's super fun and cool. I guess that stalled out in development. But he, Paul Rudd, and Ira were going to make a movie based on the This American Life story about basically the history of cryogenics.
Oh, yeah.
And a feature, like a narrative feature. And, that would have been awesome.
Mm. That would have been
stalled
awesome.
Stalled out, yeah.
So he was he a police officer before he got into documentary filming?
Was he? Sure doesn't seem like a police officer.
I think I read once that he was a police officer, which what got him interested in Thin Blue Line eventually
really?
Led to Thin Blue Line. Yeah,
holy shit.
Before he got into filmmaking. Yeah, I don't know much about Errol.
He doesn't have a real police officer-y vibe.
Yeah, some of those cats lose that once they retire. They get a little less upright and straight and kind of slump a little more.
Yeah, I haven't heard that before, but yeah, I don't know that much about him. Particularly, I've only really seen like this one in Fog of War. Yeah,
I went like Thin Blue Line is the first Errol Morris documentary I saw, and I saw that in the early '90s, and I just remember like watching that and just being like, I didn't know you can make documentaries that looked like this,
right?
You know, that gave you this feel and those like reenactments that he had where you were like, was there a camera? It's so well done. Sometimes you forget that it's a reenactment because it looks so well. It's so well produced and well acted and stuff. And then to find out that it helped exonerate that guy, you know, which is awesome. That's one of the things I love about documentaries.
And when you talk about, I mean, you're talking about a film that was, you know, about something really important, a really big deal. This guy's life.
Very.
And there is no other way to tell that story effectively other than the one that Errol Morris invented, essentially,
right,
to tell that story, right? Because your subject is a guy who's in jail. So, like, you can't have him come out and you can't film him going around doing stuff.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And it's about a narrative that happened years before, right? And so, like, there's not even, like, court dates to film. You know?
Yeah, nothing.
Which is like what you would do if you were making a straight documentary about the same subject. You know, you'd film him going through court dates and going through
like Paradise Lost.
Or Jinx. Yeah.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, it's a really remarkable, powerful film. Now, I kind of wish I hadn't watched that when I was a teenager because I found it deeply upsetting.
Yeah.
I actually have never watched Fog of War for that reason.
Fog of War is hard to watch.
Yeah.
It's hard to watch. When he mentions that Henry Kissinger bombed parts of Vietnam because he had too much coffee that day, you're just like, what?
I just heard that really – I just heard something about a bio came out about Nixon, and it's all this stuff. Like, I didn't know how much of a raging alcoholic he was and how much, like, Kissinger just kind of ran things when Nixon was just blotto.
Yeah, there was a great the Fresh Air interview with the
that's
author
what it was,
of
yeah.
that book. Yeah.
That's right. That's what I heard.
Apparently, yeah. like, there were significant times when Nixon was literally too drunk to be the president.
Whoa.
And he also, like, couldn't resign because at the time there was no vice president, you know, because of Spiro Agnew.
Right. Mm.
And so there was, like, a period where he sort of wanted to resign, but he basically, like, running down the line, you had alcoholics running Congress that couldn't be trusted with the presidency. You had no vice president. You had a foreign-born a Secretary of State.
Right.
And so, like, you're getting down to, like, the Transportation Secretary is going to become president.
Right. Oh, man. That's
super dark.
I for me, like, I don't know. Rodney Brooks was the guy that in Fast, Cheap, and Out of Control that I really enjoyed watching. I enjoyed all of them most. But, like, part of it is I looked up his, like, wiki page, and he founded iRobot, which is a great company that makes the Roomba.
Okay.
Yeah. So, like, it makes sense from, like, 97 to 2015, you find that his trajectory was to make these, like, really interesting, palatable consumer robot things, you know, that he's talking about in 97. Like, mm-hmm. he's talking about having...
Oh, yeah, cleaning the dust of the TV.
Yeah, yeah.
It's the same idea. It's basically a Roomba idea, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And then you find out he actually did it. And then intelligence running in the background, that was the one thing he kept talking about. It was like, at some point, we're going to have intelligence that's running in the background where you're like, you can walk into the room and the lights will just come on. And you'll have, like, smart light switches and stuff, exactly what they have, you know. I thought that, for me, that was cool because you got to see... I don't know what's happened with naked moles in the last, you know, 18 years, but I can certainly see the development of what he was putting together.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. I also liked that there are robots now. This is so weird because I watched this in Samsara and almost the same time, and there's, like, so much weird robot stuff in there also and a lot of weird animal stuff in there. But, yeah, when you were saying earlier that you thought – Errol Morris directly was impacted public radio. You're talking about, like, how he affected This American Life specifically.
Yeah, sure.
Has he done stuff for radio otherwise?
I don't think he ever has done anything for radio directly. But, you know, he's worked with Ira since Ira, you know, in addition to that movie, a couple of other things, I think, as well. And, you know, was a big influence on the This American Life television show, which is also totally amazing if folks haven't seen
it. That's right. Yeah, that didn't go very long, that TV show.
No, I think basically they did not realize how much work it was to make a television show.
Okay, I always thought it was maybe the idea that what they did worked so much better as audio than as video.
No, I think they were super – I sincerely think they were super happy with how the TV show came out. And I've seen all the episodes of the TV show. It is great.
Okay. I'll have to go back to that. Yeah,
yeah, but I think ultimately – and they, you know, they had to change what they do to some extent to accommodate for that same reason. Mm-hmm. But, yeah, I think that ultimately they were like, we could spend an entire year making 4 or 5 half hours – or we could spend an entire year making 35 hours of radio. And they decided, you know, we're on Showtime, 100,000 people or 250,000 people watch our show on Showtime. On the radio, 3 million people listen. Like, you know.
It's a no-brainer at that point.
Yeah.
Yeah. One of my I wrote down this quote from Dave Hoover, the animal trainer, where he said the problem with wild animals is they're like people, you can't trust them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I just like that circular logic was really compelling to me, whereas like he's like, you can't trust them because they're like me because you can't trust me because I'm a person that you can't trust.
All you got to do is put a chair in front of them. They're too confused by 4 objects instead of 1. I'm like, that is like what Facebook is. It's like, why we're not doing anything. Like you just put a chair in front of me.
Yeah.
I'm just like, ugh, I'm going to touch this part of the chair.
Yeah. I think that speaks to another theme of the movie with all of these dudes, which is the idea of control. You know, that these guys are all living in worlds where you know, the extent to which they control their environment is incredibly important. You know, whether it's these naked mole rats who he's studying, who have these social behaviors that that are completely dependent on their interrelationships, or these robots that, rather than the traditional thing, which is to program a robot to know what to do in every situation, he's only putting in a couple of inputs and allowing it to learn from there. Or the lion tamer who has to learn how to, you know, demonstrate mastery over these lions, and you know what I mean?
Absolutely. Yeah. I think that's, and it goes into back to the title, Fast, Cheap, and Out of Control. And, you know, I was reading about this where there's an old engineer saying fast, cheap, and reliable. Mm-hmm. You can only have two, you can't have three.
Yeah.
And it made me think about what was Errol Morris trying to say with the fast, cheap, and out of control.
Well, that actually makes me think more about the topiary guy as being an exception, because what he does is like the long game. It's like, it is more, he seems like he's cheap labor in a way, but you're getting quality at over a very long, like a lifetime. That's crazy that his whole life's work is that. That's when I think about that. But he's not, it's not like a thing. That's why I say it's low stakes. It's not like he's going to turn around and a bush is going to kill him. So that topiary bear is not going to reach out and claw him to death, but it does sort of like deal with some of those aspects.
But I think
like,
the stakes there are, I totally understand what you're saying. Mm-hmm. I think the stakes for the topiary artist are the stakes of art, essentially, mm-hmm. that like he is creating his vision of beauty for the world, you know, and the central tragedy of it is that one of the reasons that we create art is to create something that lives beyond us, and fundamentally his work cannot live beyond him.
Right.
He was also the only guy that they interviewed that still had his work clothes on. You know, he was still in his topiary look. And I get the feeling that's what how he dresses all the time.
I bet that guy always wears that butterfly tie.
Yeah, that guy probably bow tie. He loves, you know, he loves that butterfly tie.
Yeah. That guy buys all his clothes at museum stores.
Yeah. I'm sure now he probably has a naked mole rat tie.
Yeah,
that would be kind of cool. So Jesse, we usually end this with I ask basically, what is the documentary that got you into loving documentaries, or what's one of the first documentaries you saw that you were just like, oh man, I need to see more documentaries in my life?
Wow, that's interesting. This is one of them. But I will say one other. That I saw as a young man that affected me as much as any film I've ever seen is F for Fake, Orson Welles' F for Fake, which I also saw as a teenager.
I just watched that.
Yeah, probably rented it from Lost Weekend Video put aside my combination of feelings of admiration because they had these Brass Eye bootleg VHSs that I really wanted to watch.
Those things were great.
But then my resentment over gentrification. it was a real mix of feelings whenever I would go in there.
That is a real mix of feelings.
It's right. It's old enough that at one point it was gentrification and now it's not. It's like the holdout.
Oh, yeah. It was like the ultimate symbol of gentrification. I'm not going to get into that because that's a two-hour podcast there. But... F for Fake, which I think also embodies the idea that you can make a film which is about like the most important things in the world that is also fun and funny, which F for Fake absolutely is. I mean, it's like super great time watching that movie, even as somebody that, you know, doesn't like old stuff like me. So those two things. And
how old were you when you saw it?
Maybe I was 17 or something like that. Oh. You know, that's my best guess.
That's a great one to see at that age.
Yeah, I've seen it a few times since, and I still love it every bit as much. That. And then I think the one moment in a documentary that defines made me love documentaries as an art form more than any other is, you guys have probably seen Spellbound, right?
Oh yeah.
Do you guys remember in the Spellbound when the one kid who's sort of like Asperger's-y goes, do I sound like a musical robot?
I remember I said,
oh my God. Oh, I know the guy who directed, well, the guy who, well, he and his brother like co-made it or whatever, but this guy, Jeff Blitz, who also makes my friend Andy Daly's show Review.
Oh, okay.
On Comedy Central. Really, but he's one of the guys who made Spellbound. And they were on the show like when I was still in college. And I remember talking to him about that. And, like, he was also excited to talk about the part where he goes, do I sound like a musical robot? And I was like, oh, this guy's a cool guy. If he's down to talk about that.
Yeah, that's really cool. Well, thanks so much. I also want to say I do still have some Prank the Dean video footage.
Oh, good. Thank God.
You guys did the very first Remain event, first show.
The people demand to see 22-year-old Jesse flailing about on stage.
That's right. Well, thanks so much, Jesse. Appreciate you meeting with us. Hey, thanks for listening.
You can find episodes of SupDoc on iTunes, SoundCloud, Stitcher, and TuneIn. Please subscribe to the show, review, and rate us.
You can follow Jesse Thorne on Twitter at Jesse Thorne and find out more about his podcast network at MaximumFun.org.
Please follow us on Twitter at SupDocPodcast and online at SupDocPodcast.com.
This show is produced by Will I Love Egg Scoville, and our theme music is by David I Like Trees Siegel. If you want to suggest a documentary or a future guest, please email us at supdocpodcast@gmail.com.
We're going to be naked mole ratting it out of here.
We sure are.